Well, chapter 16 of Judges gives us the final days of the most famous judge of all, and that is Samson. They are sad verses because it's a sad ending, the end of his life. It wasn't glorious at all. It was very, very sad. And what I'd like to do tonight, instead of just brushing over it, because he is considered the most famous of all the judges, and I say that because four chapters of the book are devoted to his life, when you might have a verse in another portion of the book that covers the entire life of another judge. So four chapters are devoted to him. And I think God doesn't do it by accident. I think it's there that we might learn some vital lessons. So what we want to do is sort of take the end of chapter 16, but get an overview of Samson's life and see what he did right and what he did wrong. A few years ago, when Dr. Billy Graham had his crusade up in San Jose, California, I flew up there for that event because that was the city where I gave my life to Christ. And I flew up there with Franklin, and I was up in San Jose, and we were back stadium for the event. And I was with Dr. Graham, and I said, "You know, Bill," no, I said, "You know, Dr. Graham, this is a special place and evening for me because in this very town, just a few blocks from here, so many years ago, I gave my life to Jesus Christ watching you on television. I think you were broadcasting from Seattle at the time, but I watched that afternoon and gave my life to Christ." And I was sitting with this elder statesman, prophet to the nations, who was now very aged, and just thinking about how he has been faithful to not only start well, but finish well. All the way through, steadied the course. And I sat there admiring him, thinking, I want to end like this. I want to end well. Well, we deal with somebody tonight who did not end well. He began as a Nazarite. That was the vow that he was given as a child. It was a perpetual vow of dedication throughout his life. He had a godly heritage with his parents. An angel came and predicted his life and birth. I mean, he had everything going for him. But I would say he squandered it. And we'll see why tonight, and we'll also see, hopefully, how to avoid it. Well, when you mention the word, the name, Billy Graham, to almost anybody on planet Earth, and I've done this in different places, they go, "Oh, yes, Billy Graham, yes, Billy. We know him. Hallelujah." Because ever since 1945, when he started as a 27-year-old evangelist, I mean, he came out of the blocks running, and he hasn't quit since. An evangelist for Youth for Christ, etc. But there are a couple of other names that you share them with people, and they go, "Huh?" Charles Templeton is one, a contemporary of Billy Graham's. Started with him, we're good friends. In fact, when Charles Templeton started preaching, the press in America said he was the best young preacher ever. Not Billy, this guy, Charles Templeton. The best ever. Another contemporary, Bron Clifford. Evangelical press said that he affected more leaders at a young age and was the best preacher that America had seen. You know, sort of a toss-up between Templeton and Clifford. In fact, I found a quote from that era. Listen to this. "At the age of 25, young Clifford has touched more lives and influenced more leaders and has set more attendance records than any other clergyman in American history." That's an incredible statement. The reason we haven't heard of those two fellas is because they started well, but they ended very poorly. Whereas Billy started well and is ending very well. 5 years after beginning in this whirlwind fame of ministry, Charles Templeton denied that he believed in Jesus Christ. Denied the faith completely, this great preacher. Bron Clifford lost his family, his ministry, and eventually his life to alcoholism and squandering resources. It got so bad that though he was from the East, he died in Amarillo, Texas. And the local clergyman in Amarillo took up a collection just to get enough money to send his body back east to be buried in a graveyard for the poor. He lost it all. Beginning with a bang, you might say, ending with a whimper. A very, very sad way to end. Jesus said, "My food, my meat," in the King James, "my food is to do the will of him that sent me and to," anybody, "and to finish it." What I live for is to do the will of God, the Father who sent me, and to finish it. And that's a good motto. That would have been a good motto for Samson to abide by. What is the will of God? And not just to do it now, but to perpetuate it so that at the end I can cross the finish line and say, "It's finished. I've done it." That was Paul's whole desire. When he faced the crowd at Ephesus on the way to Jerusalem, and they warned him through the prophets saying, "Don't go to Jerusalem, Paul. You're going to be beaten. You're going to be bound. It's bad if you go." He looked at the crowd and he said, "None of these things move me. Neither do I count my life dear unto myself, that I might finish my course with joy and the ministry that I have received from the Lord Jesus." Isn't that beautiful? I don't care. I just want to make sure that I'm living passionately for Jesus and I can say, "I've done it. I finished it. I finished my course with joy. I finished the ministry God has given me to do." Now, I have met people who started well. I've watched them get saved. I've seen the tears in their eyes. I've seen that sincerity of heart. But then I've watched them over time. I've watched them drop out of fellowship. I've watched them drop out of relationships, marriages. And I've seen them bottom out. That's why I am never cocky, saying, "Well, you know, I am a spiritual giant and I've been a Christian for this many years." I just say, "Oh, Lord, unless you keep me by your grace, unless you keep me by your grace, I could end up the same. There but for the grace of God go I," as the saying goes. So he that thinks he stand, let's use biblical terms now, he who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. Samson fell. I mentioned he's the best known of the judges. Everybody who has grown up in Sunday school has heard of Samson. In fact, one time in my son's room, though probably now he wouldn't want you to know about this or admit to it, he had these cartoon posters, and one of the posters was Samson. You know, and it's always holding those pillars, right, pushing them out, and we're going to look at that tonight as we sort of close off the story. It has been said that nations get the governments that they deserve. That's a statement that is often made, and I don't know if that's true or not. Sometimes it certainly is. Sometimes it's not always true. But I will say this, in a democracy where you start voting for people, or leaders emerge from the masses, the leadership reflects the values of the people because we get to vote who we want in office. And usually people vote for people who reflect their own value system. We like what they stand for. We want them in office. Samson is very much like that. He is a personal microcosm of what has gone on in the nation of Israel. Every man does what is right in his own eyes. Guess what? Samson lives by that motto. I will do what I feel like I should do at the moment. Doing what is right in Samson's own eyes. Now, I did mention, and we have sort of covered this in the last couple weeks, no one had better opportunities to finish well than this guy. He had so many resources, and yet he squandered them. He failed in that. And I imagine that by the end of chapter 16, when he's in this prison, where we just touched on it last week, and he's blind and he's grinding like an ox, he's probably thinking very heavily, remorseful thoughts, don't you think? Oh, what I could have been by the grace of God and with the resources that God has given me. But I'm not. And that's the way he ended. There's an old Chinese proverb that described a fool this way: outside, noisy, inside, empty. Make a lot of noise, a big splash, but inside there's nothing there. No real character, just all reputation on the outside. We're going to actually begin looking at a couple of verses to bring us up to speed, because I want to notice something about his life together. Let's just go back at chapter 14 for just a moment. And before we read a couple verses in 14, 15, and 16 to sort of sum up this guy's life, I was thinking today how I would describe Samson. And I would basically describe a guy who lived by uncontrolled passions. That is, he lacked self-control. He lacked self-control, which, by the way, is part of the fruit of the Spirit. Uncontrolled passions. Now, we all have desires. We all have passions that are good, and many of them are put in us by God. But all of those passions must be tethered to the Spirit of God by self-control. Proverbs 25:28, a familiar proverb, says, "A person without self-control is as defenseless as a city with broken down walls." Isn't that descriptive? Defenseless, like a walled city in the ancient biblical times whose walls had been fallen down or easy to be breached, they're defenseless. That's a person without self-control, open to anything, and could fall suddenly. And then Galatians 5, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace. Usually we stop. That's about the only three most Christians know. Love, joy, peace. Here's the rest: long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And you know what self-control means? The ability to restrain your passions. The ability to have desires safely tethered. You admit that you have the desires, but though they are there, they're governed by God. Now, an athlete has to have self-control for what he or she does. They have controlled, they have mastered their desires, so they don't get up in the morning and have four Snickers, you know, and then jars of peanut butter. They say, no, I've got a diet, I've got to run so many miles, and they live a disciplined life. In the Spirit, as a believer, self-control is essential. Now, I've had to turn to chapter 14, verse 1, because this is sort of where we begin to see this guy's problem. Uncontrolled passion number one was lust. Verse 1, Samson went down to Timnah and saw — we really zeroed in on that last time — saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. So he went and told his father and mother, saying, "I've seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as a wife," this young whippersnapper demands of his parents. Then his father and mother said to him, "Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" And Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she pleases me well." That's hint number one, that lust was one of his uncontrolled passions. Physically attracted to a gal, now he just wants her as wife. Look at verse 18. He says of this wife that he's now married to the people who figured out the riddle, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle." Hardly shows love to this woman that he wanted as his wife, because a heifer is a female cow that's temperamental who hasn't had children yet. It's not a compliment. That is why, if you look in chapter 15, verse 2, listen to her father now. Her father said, "I really thought you thoroughly hated her." That's his response and the reason that he gave the wife to Samson's best man. Even the father knew that Samson didn't love the daughter. That was just lust at first sight. He lusted after her. He looked at a woman, pleased her, and said, she's my wife. She is a knockout. Got to have her. Get her for me. But the dad says, "I thought you hated her." you talked about her as a heifer. Chapter 16, verse 1. Now Samson went to Gaza, saw a harlot there, and went into her. That is, spent the night and had sexual relations, paid the money for it, because here's part of his uncontrolled passion, lust. Verse 4. Afterward, it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. I think if Samson would have lived in our modern times, at least the last several years, he would have loved that Stephen Stills song popular in the 60s, "If you can't be with the one you love, then love the one you're with." That's what he did. He goes, "Oh, well, that wife's out of the picture. I really like her. She's a harlot. Okay, that's over. I love her." He's just going from one chick to another. Uncontrolled passion. And the first one being lust. There's nothing wrong with being attracted to another person physically. In fact, let me just clear the air there. God put that within you. That's how people get married. Initially, there's a magnetism. You go, "Whoa, she's cute. And I saw my wife." I didn't say, "Boy, I never want to be with her, but I feel it's God's will." So, no. I said, "She's cute. Which I want to find out her name." And then we found out about each other's background. And then we dated and we prayed together and we grew spiritually, etc. But that desire that can be natural and God-given, as we mentioned last week, must be God-governed. Self-control. The passion has to be tethered. Job struggled with it. Here's a guy who's diseased, beat up, ravaged by life, and he said these words, "I have made a covenant with my eyes." Men, this would be a good covenant for us to make. I know we sign contracts with everyone else, but how about making a deal with our eyeballs? And here's the deal. "That I should not gaze intently upon a young woman." That's self-control. That's the passion tethered. He's going to see a young maiden, a young woman, and he's going to notice that she's beautiful. Nothing wrong with that. But he's not going to keep looking and mentally undressing her and lusting after her in his heart. That's the idea of that verse. "I've made a covenant, a deal with my eyes, that I will not gaze intently upon a young woman." Now, we fight a powerful force. It's a city named Hollywood. And it is a very powerful force, admit it. It has lowered our defenses, and it has made a lot of people compromise. "Oh, everybody's into that. Everybody sees this stuff. No big deal. It's a great movie. Just four sex scenes. No problem." That's how we think nowadays. And in every one of those is a message from Hollyweird that is telling you that it's okay. Everybody does it. Lust is fine. Love the one you're with. Free love. Now their big thing is safe sex. It's okay as long as it's safe sex. Sex is safe in a monogamous marriage. Outside of that, there is pain emotionally and there is disease that many people are facing. But they lie. They make it so glamorous and so appealing, calling it safe. God did give passion. I think God gave sex as a wonderful gift to us. But it does need to be in its place. Fire is great in the fireplace. You take it out and decide to put it on the kitchen table just to get it a little closer while you eat, and you will die. Or the example I often use is dark soil looks beautiful in a tended garden. Pull it out of the garden and track it all over your wife's new white shag carpet. It suddenly looks out of place. It's not appropriate anymore. "What's wrong with soil, man? It's natural." That won't go very well within your home, will it? And that's what a lot of people say about sexual. "Oh, it's natural." Yeah, it's natural, but it has a place. It's better in one place, and it can be destructive in another. So that's uncontrolled passion number one in summing up his life, lust. Second, I believe, is arrogance. I think he was a prideful person. Back a couple chapters, and by the way, here's why. God gave him a supernatural strength, a real gift. Physically, he was stronger than anyone else. He made Arnold Schwarzenegger look like Michael Jackson in comparison. I mean, this guy was just beefy. But he used his gift from God, his supernatural strength, for himself. Even though God did use him more in spite of who he was than because of who he was, he used it in a self-aggrandizement kind of a way. He kills a lion a few chapters back. And he can't resist when he goes back to Timnah to be married to this gal to just go through that area where he killed and check it out. We certainly see pride when he's with Delilah. We sort of went through that and then stopped last week. He plays with temptation. He thinks arrogantly that he can stand up to it. Oh, I know she's tempted me. I mean, it was pretty obvious, right? She says, Samson, if you love me, you'll tell me where your strength lies so that I can have you bound. Oh, well, okay. He just falls right into it. He must have seen it as some seduction sexually. He toyed with it. He played with it. And he thought, I can handle this chick. No problem. It was arrogance. It was pride. And pride, uncontrolled pride, not kept in check, not tethered, not submitted to God, oh, Lord, make me humble. That wasn't Samson. That can destroy. That can destroy marriages, friendships, businesses. Virtually anything can be destroyed by pride. Uncontrolled passion number three was his anger, right? This guy, revenge was his middle name. And then he justified himself. Okay, you really made me mad now. And then he justified himself by saying something like, I can't be held responsible for what I'm about to do. Then he'd kill people. Hardly somebody who reflected his calling. He was called a Nazarite, one dedicated to God in full-time ministry. Great name, great title, great position. But it was in name only. He was a very violent man. He was not dedicated to God. Example. When the Philistines figured out the riddle because they threatened his wife, and now he owes 30 guys changes of clothing, he goes down to Ashkelon and kills 30 men in Ashkelon, strips them of their clothes, and takes it back to pay off the debt. Then, when he comes back to Timnah with a young goat for his wife to consummate the marriage, finds out that dad pulled a switcheroony and put his wife with the best man, he's so angry. And a skirmish develops. He takes 150 pairs of foxes or jackals, ties their tails together, puts a firebrand in the middle of them, sends them through the crops so that the olives, the vineyards and the grain is all destroyed. Granted, once again, I want to give the big perspective as well as this. God did use this guy to rid the enemy out of their land, but hardly was this some kind of righteous vindication. He was motivated out of pure anger. Personal vengeance was his motivation. In James chapter 1, verse 20 says, "The wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God." And I'll tell you why I say that. Because you could be tempted to read into the story, oh, it doesn't matter. God covered for him anyway. So I'll just sort of live the way I want and trust that God will cover for me. Well, God does honor his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in ridding the children of Israel from this enemy. It does not make, however, what Samson did righteous, as James points out. Revenge. Uncontrolled anger, uncontrolled passion, lust, arrogance, and anger, not producing the righteousness of God. For some of you, anger is a real problem. For others of you, lust is a real problem. And for still others, pride is. Pride is. Hard for you to humble yourself. Any of these things, and there are others, but three that really picture this guy, can destroy your life and others' lives. Now, I know we call it evening the score, right, when it comes to revenge. Well, they deserve this. That was what he did. He justified himself all the way along the line. Tit for tat, you know. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. except it wasn't eye for eye. Okay, you got this riddle right. I got to kill people now. That is definitely going overboard, wouldn't you say? You really made me mad, so I'm just going to destroy all your crops. I mean, this guy, it was uncontrolled passion. But some of you, like Samson, and all of us have the capability, as our Achilles heel, our weak spot in our life, is anger. Now, you may justify and say, well, you know, I'm Irish. Or I'm Italian. Or I'm, you know, you can say that about anything. I'm hot-blooded, you know, South America, whatever. Just call it sin, all right? That's what it is. You could say, well, I'm temperamental. Well, that's about, what, 90% temper, 10% mental. Because you don't think usually when you fly off the handle. Let me say this. If you, like Samson, are controlled by your anger, get help. Seriously, get help. Deal with it. Because the Bible says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. That means every day there ought to be an inventory taken and channels of communication cleared before you go to bed. So that if you've got a problem with your wife, don't go to bed on it. Clear the channel. Ask for forgiveness. Pray about it together. Now, how many people do you know do that? Let's look at the other side of the coin. Not doing that day after day, week after week, month after month. You know what that does to a person? It destroys them. And it destroys other relationships. I want to read something to you. It's a research group that did a study on 192 married couples. This is what they found. 75% of the men who died from cancer had wives who suppressed their anger. And the men who suppressed their anger had a greater risk of dying of cardiovascular disease. Here's why, the researchers explained. Suppressing basic emotions tends to alter the balance of daily routines, creating stress, disrupting sleep. Men seem more vulnerable because they are dependent on the most emotional support from their wives, even though many would not admit it, they are. And it creates stress and anxiety and disease. So God's word, God put that there for a reason. Don't let the sun go down in your wrath. That means you got to humble yourself. You can't be prideful like Samson. And if you're angry by nature, your old nature, get help. Deal with it. If you can't do it on your own, get some spiritual counseling. Get some help. Well, one day Samson, and this is now chapter 16, we're going to come up to par here. He goes down to Gaza. It's 40 miles from his hometown of Zorah. Walks into town. His lust overtakes him because he sees a harlot. Goes to bed with her. But around midnight, he pulls the gates out of the city, walks him up to a hill facing Hebron. The five lords of the Philistines, they're called. There's five cities down south that we mentioned, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza, Gath, and Ekron. Those are the five cities, the Pentapolis. Five lords of the Philistines go to Delilah, whom he marries subsequently from verse 4 on, saying, tell you what, Delilah, we really need to get your husband. He's really been a problem to us, and we want you to be the instrument for his fall and capture. What do you think? It's not going to go very far. They're newlyweds, right? She's madly in love with him. And she may have even said, oh, no, I could never do that. I love him. He's so handsome and strong, and I just love him. And so we'll tell you what. We'll give you 1,100 pieces of silver each. Each? Yeah, that would be 5,500 pieces of silver. Really? Well, you know, I do want to be patriotic here and stand up for my country. And if he is a spy, and you know, she probably justified it. Money does talk. Judas sold Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. This is 5,500. It's interesting how you put money into a situation and people get highly motivated. I found this in USA Today. A group of researchers from New York asked people about their values. Here's the article, a little portion of it. Quote, 7% of us the American public, according to their research. 7% of us say they would murder someone for enough money. You know, they said, well, would you do it for 100, for 1,000, for 1,000,000? And 7%. That's one in every 14 people, according to this article. Whether they could actually pull the trigger or not is another question, but 36 million of us would be willing at least to consider the offer. Well, Delilah was part of that 7%. Oh, okay. So they get together, Samson and Delilah, and she says, "Tell Samson, honey, you know, you're so sweet, and I love you so very much, you know. And could you tell me the secret of your great strength that you might be afflicted?"
Yeah. Okay, Delilah.
And he falls into this trap, of course. I really do think the guy was lame, personally, as I go through the story. In verse 7, "If they bind me," he says, "with 7 fresh bowstrings not yet dried, I shall be weak as any other man." She does it. He breaks them like they're flax when she says, "The Philistines are upon you." Then she weeps, "Oh, honey, you lied to me. Tell me the secret of your strength." Verse 11, "If they bind me securely with new ropes that have never been used, I'll be weak as any other man." She does that. He breaks them quickly when she says, "The Philistines are upon you." And then she weeps on him again. "Why are you doing this to me?" "What? Why are you? Let's reverse this, huh? Why are you doing this to me?" But he didn't let on. Verse 13, "Well, if you weave the 7 locks of my head into the web of a loom, I will be weak as any other man." She does that. He breaks the trap. Verse 16, "And it came to pass, when she pestered him daily with her words and pressed him so that his soul was vexed to death." This is a henpecked husband. His soul is vexed to death. That's strong language. "That he told her all of his heart." He told her all of his heart. Mark this. Temptation for Samson was a game. He didn't take sin seriously enough. He thought, "I can handle this. This is kind of cool. This could be seductive. This is her way of coming on to me. I like this." He no doubt saw it like that, given his background. And she pestered him, kept bugging him. So much like Satan. I see so many parallels. You know, Satan doesn't, when you resist temptation effectively once, say, "Okay, I quit." I'll be back. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger said, he'll keep coming at you till he gets to that weak spot. Even with Jesus, he was tempted, he was tempted, he was tempted. And then even when Satan left, because Jesus said, "Leave," it says he waited for an opportune time. He left until there was an opportune time. And he does that with us. He'll be back. Well, Samson's natural instinct is to fall into this trap, to be allured by this beautiful young woman, who is at this point his wife. And though his natural impulse is to be allured, know this, the man had choice. He still had his choice, and he made the wrong choice. I've given this example before, and if we had a setup, I'd actually do it for you. But if I lifted up the lid of the piano, this is how temptation works in an analogy. If you lift up the lid of that piano, and you sit at the keyboard, and you press there's 3 pedals on the bottom. The right pedal is the sustain pedal. It'll take the felt board away from the string, so they're just kind of suspended. Once you push the sustain pedal, keep the lid open, and you sing whatever note you can do into the piano. And you keep that pedal down, at least one, if not more, strings will pick up your note and vibrate, and so they'll sing your note back to you. You could keep the pedal down, sing, whoa, stop, and you'll hear that sustain coming back at you. It's vibrating. That's how temptation works. Satan calls, and we vibrate. That's exactly how it works. He uses different allurements that attract us. We go, oh, And it could be a number of things. It could be a position, could be power, could be money, could be sexuality. Satan calls and we vibrate. We have a desire to respond to his calls. With a piano, though you can sing into it and get a response, that's not how it's meant to work. The way it's meant to work is to respond not to a voice, but to the hammers as you play with your fingers. The hammers strike the note and it plays. When Satan calls and there's that feeling to vibrate, what do? Do you just go, okay, I can handle it? No, you close the lid. Once you close the lid to that thing, it's not going to do it anymore. The sound doesn't penetrate the wood. And so the allurements come. Satan calls, hey, you, he dangles something up. Close the door of the temptation. That's why Joseph fled the house when Potiphar's wife, back in Genesis, grabbed him and said, come to bed with me. Come to bed with me. He closed the piano lid. He ran out of the house. He didn't stand there and go, Lord, right now, just help me face this temptation and just with one eye open and just let me handle this. He got out of there. And that's wisdom. We all know, maybe looking at a certain television show or a certain place where there's magazines is too tough for you. Don't stand around there to see if you can handle it. Get out of there. Close the piano lid. That's what happened in the garden. That's how we got into this mess. The piano lid wasn't closed. Eve said, the serpent beguiled me, and I did eat. The decision was made. Serpent called, hey, and I did eat. She made the choice. So we still have the choice. Martin Luther said, and I love this quote, you cannot stop birds from flying around your head, but you can prevent them from building a nest in your hair. You're always going to be tempted throughout your life. You do have passions, but they need to be tethered. So when Satan calls, learn how to close the lid. Learn how to use the spirit-controlled, the self-control, as is the fruit of the Spirit. So verse 17, he told her all of his heart. He said, no razor has ever come upon my head. I've been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and become like any other man. And as we mentioned 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago now, I don't remember, his strength wasn't in his hair. His strength wasn't in his arms, though he killed 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of a donkey. His strength wasn't in his back, though he could carry the gates of the city of Gaza up to a hill facing Hebron. His strength was in his covenant relationship with God. He had taken the vow of a Nazarite. The hair was simply the badge of the vow. He was crossing lines all through his life, making compromise after compromise, but finally he touched this vow that God somehow honored despite this guy's despicable behavior. And the badge was gone, the covenant had been broken, and he is powerless. When Delilah saw that he told all of his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, come up once more, for he has told me all of his heart. So the lords of the Philistines came and brought the money in their hand, paid her off. Notice verse 19. This just jumped out at me today. Then she lulled him to sleep on her knees, called for a man, had him shave off the 7 locks of his head, and she began to torment him, and his strength left him. Isn't that just like Satan? He lulls you, and then when you say yes to his calling, then he torments you. First there is temptation, then there is condemnation. That's how he works. Come on, man, do this. It's okay. There's no problem. You can get away with this. And so you go for it. You grab the bait. And as soon as you do, as soon as he's lulled you, he starts tormenting you. I can't believe you did that. You can't get away with this. Then he starts condemning you. Don't go to church tonight, whatever you do. You're not worthy to be around those people. Don't read the Bible. God's not going to listen to you. All of that torment. When he's the one that entices you to do it, okay, I'll do it. And then he brings the condemnation and the accusation. We should not be ignorant of Satan's devices. He works just like this. And she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." He awoke from his sleep and said, "I will go out as before at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. About a week and a half ago, Saturday afternoon, my computer was plugged into the wall. Remember what happened that Saturday afternoon? Well, I have a laptop computer, so when the power goes out, at least it's got a battery for a while. Well, I didn't know that I was on battery. I'm working away on my message for Saturday and Sunday. I'd been doing it all week, and this little battery low thing goes on. I thought it was just some kind of an appliance defect, when in effect, I had no electricity feeding that computer, and it was just dying. It's a good appliance. It's a great computer, but even the best appliance severed from its power source is useless. And here is Samson severed from his source, his relationship with God. He didn't know it, just like I was working away. I didn't know there was a power outage until I got in my car and figured it out. Every stoplight in town is out. That is why Jesus used a powerful Greek word, abide in me. Abide in me. Literally translated, the best I think is maintain a constant, ongoing, living communion with me. Not a once a week check in, check out, but daily, minute by minute, be connected to him, fellowship with him, pour your heart out to him, confess your sins to him, abide in him. Then the Philistines took him, put out his eyes, brought him down to Gaza, their principal city, bound him with bronze fetters, and he became a grinder in the prison. Now, grinding grain is humiliating, especially for a warrior, because in that time, slaves and women, and by the way, slaves and women were often on the same par in ancient cultures, unfortunately. That's who would grind the grain. Now, here's this great warrior doing it, and he's humiliated by it. And I bet now begins that thought process. What I could have been, what I should have been by the grace of God, and all the mistakes that he had made. Think of it. Samson traded in the best for the very least. He traded in a lifetime of significance for a moment of sin. A lifetime for a moment. Immediate gratification versus the eternal perspective. Moses was faced with some similar choices, the book of Hebrews tells us. He was the son of Pharaoh's daughter. But the writer of Hebrews says, by faith, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather, listen to this, to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasure of sin for a season. One was passing, one was eternal. And he stepped back and looked at the big picture and said, if I choose this, I'll be happy, I'll be wealthy, I'll have whatever I want at my disposal temporarily. But if I choose this, though it will be painful, in the long run, in the scope of all of eternity, I'll be happier. So he chose the eternal over the temporary. Whereas Samson chose the temporary over the eternal. Traded it in. F.B. Meyer wrote these words, "This is the bitterest of all, to know that suffering need not have been, that it has resulted from indiscretion and inconsistency, that it is the harvest of one's own sowing, that the vulture which feeds on the vitals is a nestling of one's own rearing." Oh, me, says Meyer, this is pain. And I have met people in that kind of pain. I've met people in a variety of situations, and my heart breaks every time they say, "I remember when you counseled me, Skip. I remember what you said, and I remember saying, I'm not going to do that. And now I wish I would have." And they describe their situation. And my heart breaks. I don't go, "Well, you told you so. See?" I just want to put my arm around them and weep with them. It's so sad to see a life reduced to this because of disobedience. Verse 22, However, oh, thank God for that word. However, his hair, the hair of his head, began to grow again after it had been shaven. That word, however, signifies a change in the drama. It's a word of God's grace. Samson was down, but not out. Hair starts growing back. Covenant sort of being renewed. Verse 23, now the lords of the Philistines gathered together to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. And they said, our God has delivered into our hand Samson, our enemy. The ancient peoples believed that battles fought between mortals were actually battles fought by the gods of those nations. That the armies were simply emissaries of the gods. That's where holy wars come from. That's where the Crusades come from. That weird thinking that we're, you know, on a mission, a battle for God. So that whoever wins the battle, their God has won victory over the other God. In the Philistines' view, Yahweh, the God of Israel, was defeated because their champion was defeated. You remember when David killed Goliath? That was their champion, Goliath. As soon as Goliath was killed, everybody fled. The reason everybody fled, the Philistines fled, is in their view, God had just defeated Dagon, their God. No point in fighting. It's over. This was the battle we set up. When the people saw him, they praised their God. For they said, our God has delivered into our hands our enemy, this destroyer of our land, and the one who multiplied our dead. Now, I just want you to notice this for a moment. This is a worship service. This is a praise assembly going on. They're all gathered together in the temple, and they're praising Dagon. Were they sincere in their worship? Of course they were. They were as sincere as anybody else worshiping any other god in history, maybe even more so than some Christians that I know. They were sincere in worshiping Dagon, but it was false worship. Why? Who's a false god? Exactly. False worship is worshiping the wrong god. It's not about sincerity, it's about objectivity. Now, I'll tell you why I bring this up. Because this is precisely the point that we're hammered with by many philosophers of religion and unbelievers. It goes like this. Listen, all religions are just different descriptions of the very same God. That's all. Ever heard that? The example I have heard from some is that, well, it's sort of like blindfolding 10 people, leading them into your backyard where you happen to have an elephant. Not that you would. But if you did and you blindfolded 10 people, and you brought them to this large creature and you had them feel it and give a description, you'd get different descriptions. Some would say, well, I feel a wrinkled, tough surface. Others would say, oh, no, I feel something very hard and smooth if they touch the tusk. Others might put their hand in a mucous membrane. It'd be warm and moist, viscous. They might touch another part, the back of the neck, where it's hairy, a rough, thick hair. So you would have different descriptions, but the same animal. And they'll say that's what different religions are. They're merely attestations of the same God in different terms. What's wrong with that argument? It's a logical fallacy. Even though you touch different parts of the same elephant, there would be consistencies. Heart rate, heartbeat, temperature of the body, smell, things like that. They'd all be consistent. Whereas you have different religions, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, the definitions of God in all of those different worship systems are not consistent. The definitions of God of themselves are contradictory, therefore mutually exclusive. Example. If you were to read the Bhagavad Gita of the Hindus or the Upanishads of the Hindus, they believe in something called monism, that the universe is a seamless garment. You're God, I'm God, the door is God, the tree's God, the mountain's God. We're all a part of God. The Bible teaches the exact opposite, that there is a God separate and distinct from his creation. You look at Buddhism, and I talked to a Buddhist recently. Buddhism defines God as an impersonal being or an impersonal force, whereas the God of the Bible is a personal God with personality. The God of the deists is short on his display of power, unable to do all things. The God of the Bible is omnipotent, can do all things. Now, all of those things have the potential, including Christianity, all of them have the potential to be wrong, but not all of them can be right. Because you can't have a God who is totally impersonal and personal at the same time. You can't have a God who is in all things as being a part of him, yet separate and distinct from his creation. You got me? The very definitions, the fundamental definition of God is contradictory. Thus, it is false. So here they are worshiping their God, very sincere, even feeling like the God of the Israelites. He's not the true God. We've defeated them. But things will change. So it happened when their hearts were merry. Probably sousing it up a bit. They said, call for Samson that he may perform for us. This is how my mind works. I'm just displaying it for all unashamedly. So they called for Samson from the prison, and he performed for them, and they stationed him between the pillars. Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, let me feel the pillars which support the temple so I can lean on them. Now the temple was full of men and women, and the lords of the Philistines were there, about 3,000 men and women on the roof watching while Samson performed. Stop right there. I like this. Because I've heard things like, well, look at this description of a temple. We know that you don't build a temple with pillars that close to each other so that if you take them away, that is the supporting structure. It's just it's a weird idea of somebody going like this and then the whole building falling down. Until 1973. When the vice president of the Institute for Holy Land Studies in Jerusalem, and I visited the institute, wrote a letter about a dig, an archaeological dig, down at Tel Kassil, which is an old Philistine city, where they found a temple, according to his letter, from the time or before the time of the judges. And he noted in his letter, this archaeologist, that one of the telltale features is that they found two wooden column pillars set on stone bases. Archaeology showed that were close next to each other within touching distance, next to the high place of their idol, and those two columns went up in the center and supported a roof structure, sort of like a balcony structure. The structure was made out of like an adobe clay brick thing, and these pillars supported that roof structure, exactly like the Bible would indicate here. By the way, one of the chief archaeologists for Israel, now dead, Nelson Gluick, said this: no archaeological discovery has ever controverted a single biblical reference. That's interesting. No dig of archaeology has ever contradicted a single biblical reference. And I could give you many other examples. People read the Bible, John chapter 5. It talks about the Pool of Bethesda. Nobody ever heard of the Pool of Bethesda in modern times. They found no trace of it. They found no documentation of it except the Bible. And they said, see, they made this up. There is no Pool of Bethesda. Until recently, and if you come with us to Israel in 2001, I will take you to the Pool of Bethesda. And it happens to have five colonnaded porches, just like the Bible describes it. You just got to keep digging, that's all. People scoffed and said, there is no Pontius Pilate. The Bible declares him, but we see no Roman records of his existence until they dug around Caesarea, and they found a stone inscribed on it, Tiberius the emperor, Pontius Pilate the governor. And I'll show you the stone if you come with us to Israel in 2001. It sort of sounds like a pitch, but it's cool to see. Now the temple was full of men, and when we just said that, there, verse 28, Samson called to the Lord, saying, O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes. Now, it's sort of interesting. This is the first time we read of him praying. Now that he's blind, now that he's shackled, now that he's dancing around like a ninny, he goes, you know, I think I'm going to pray. And so he prays to God. Folks, I think you get the message. There is the value of extremity. There is the value of pain. There is the value of trials. Peter says it is like fire that purges away the dross. You put metal into a smelting pot and it drives away the impurities and keeps the metal pure. There is the value of certain temptations and trials. If they drive us to God, they can be very helpful, right? You know, sometimes God doesn't hear from his children until there's a crisis. Why did God let this happen? Well, you know, maybe he hadn't heard from you in a month. Now all of a sudden you're talking to him a lot. David in the psalm says, before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now I have learned to keep your word. He continues, it is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I may learn your statutes. In your faithfulness you have afflicted me. You see, not all pain is destructive. It can be helpful, just in the physical realm even. Pain is a warning system. Let's say your wife says, honey, you know, you got to just go see the doctor, get a checkup.
I don't need to go see a doctor. I feel good. I don't have time for doctors.
Till that afternoon, massive angina happens, chest pain. And then suddenly you're at the doctor asking him lots of questions. You didn't have time for him in the morning.
Now you've got all the time.
Because there's a problem that has driven you to the doctor to get help. It is good that I have been afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple, braced himself against them, one at his right and the other at his left. And Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he pushed with all of his might, and the temple fell on the Lord's and all the people who were in it. So the dead that he killed at his death were more than he killed in his life. Samson knew what the Philistines would do. As soon as Samson would die, they would desecrate his body. They did it to King Saul. They beheaded him, hung his body on the wall of Beth Shean up in northern Israel. And I was seeing the news a few years ago. After being in Mogadishu, Somalia, I saw what they did to the American soldier when he was captured. You probably still remember the scenes. How they drug his body through the streets of Mogadishu, and it was on CNN for a week. The Philistines would have done that to him. He knew it. And his brothers and all of his father's household came down and took him, that is his body, and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of his father Manoah. He had judged Israel for 20 years. What lessons do we learn with this guy? Number one, flee temptation. Don't play with it. Don't play with it. Flee it. Close the door. Close the piano lid. Second, the danger of becoming enslaved to sin. Whenever we yield to an impulse of the flesh, you are doing more than committing a sin. You are developing a habit. The longer you do it, the harder it will be to break that pattern. Jesus said, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. Paul said much the same thing. Don't yield yourselves to sin, lest you come under its bondage and become a slave. What could this guy have done to end up differently? You know, as I mentioned Bron Clifford at the beginning of this Bible study tonight, Samson ended just like him. What could Samson have done? Number one, he could have taken sin more seriously. Instead of playing with it, he could have said, this is serious business. It has the potential to destroy me. Number two, he could have placed character above reputation. He did just the opposite. He wanted to look good. He was strong. He had the reputation of being the bad guy on the block. Reputation was far more important than character. What other people thought of him was more important than what God knew about him. Third, he could have taken advantage of friendship. And I'll tell you why I mentioned that. A couple chapters back, chapter 14, he goes down to Timnah alone, no friends with him, so that they have to surround him at his wedding with 30 Philistine groomsmen, his enemies. These are the guys that he has the riddle with and kills 30 Ashkelonites to give him clothes. Most people brought their own attendants. He didn't have any friends to bring. He didn't have any godly company around him, and that's important. If you isolate yourself, the Bible says you do it to your own destruction. So I think he could have done those three things, and he would have ended very differently.